Hello, and welcome to the Gallery of Readers podcast. Today we get to hear some gorgeous pieces from Lisa Eckes, a rock star in the culinary literature world, mother and proud creator of a truly beautiful Guinness World Record-winning cookbook library in her Hatfield home. I'm Larkin, and Gallery of Readers is a nonprofit small press that organizes a reading series every year and has published 21 books by local authors. For those books, free poems, event information, and more, visit us at galleryofreaders.org. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Larkin. I'm really excited to do this. Thank you so much for asking me. My words will be out. It's really cool. So
I'm so happy you're here. This is a delight. Could you start by talking a little bit about your background with writing?
Sure. I have just kind of come off 46 years in the publishing industry. So I started when I was still at college, and I worked for a literary agency, and we helped launch Jean Owl. For instance, I was there when her manuscript came in. And then my first, quote, real full-time job out of college was at Random House. And the first week I was there, I worked with William Styron, Kurt Vonnegut, James Michener. I mean, how cool? Did I hit the jackpot or what? So this was my whole life's fantasy come true. So I had a few years in New York. I worked with amazingly talented writers. And then I moved up to Western Mass. And I've been there here for 41 years. And in that time, I've worked with thousands of writers, both general, but primarily cookbook and culinary and chefs. So a little bit of editing, a lot of PR writing. I would promote their books when they came out. So I'd have to do press releases, suggested media questions, write bios. I'd do mock interviews with them and write those up. And then I transitioned about halfway through my 41 years to being a literary agent in the culinary world. And that meant reviewing proposal ideas for cookbooks, which meant a lot of editing, a lot of reorganization. So I was always behind the scenes, not a little bit of original writing in terms of like press releases, but that's not really creative per se in light of what we're doing here.
That makes sense. You're sort of facilitating people's creativity, which is a part of the process.
Right. The side person kind of encouraging them how to do it, what to do, helping them get their words out. And now the tables have turned and I'm getting my words and my writing out. And it's a little nerve-wracking and very exciting and hugely fulfilling. I mean, who knew?
What kind of writing do you feel interested in these days?
I have coined my own word called memoristic essays. I don't want to do a novel, I know that. I didn't want to pigeonhole myself, but what I find I'm drawn to are essay-like writings, anywhere from a couple of hundred words to a couple of thousand, and they are all based on either of the moment, how I'm thinking, what I'm thinking, something that's happened, say, in politics, and very much what's happened in my life. I had a long, incredible relationship with my parents who aged in place with me until they passed. And a lot of my writing is working through that time. And so it's rather poignant, sometimes sad, and so joyful in my ability to have cared. And that's what I'm working to express. We'll see if I do it.
I think you do an excellent job from reading your work. Is that part of why you write? To work through things?
Yes, absolutely. I think not having fear, letting my thoughts flow, not being an inner critic, shutting down what I want to say until I go back and review and revise and edit, but just sort of put it out there. And frankly, that's what my work with Gallery of Readers has brought to me, the ability to just put it out there. And you have to do that before you can pull back a little.
That's spoken like someone in publishing.
Put it all out there. And then you have to what's called kill your babies, which I hate that expression, but how do you choose what to keep, what to let go, what to refine? And it's taken almost 5 decades for me to feel a level of confidence with that.
Wow. Sounds like an incredible process.
It is. And I really defer to the brilliant writers with whom I've worked. I've been so lucky.
They have been too, to have someone in their corner like you.
Thank you.
How does writing impact your life?
Writing has helped me be more in the present. I notice what I'm in, what I'm doing, how I'm thinking, and often it's like, this might become a piece. There might be something there. However, I also notice a lot of that and then I forget to write about it. But it infuses, first of all, my appreciation for what my writers have put in, my authors, is 100-fold. My admiration, my respect, what they do. And I thought I understood the long, hard journey, and now I do. My goal isn't necessarily to publish a book. Mine is the experience of the words on the page and what's mine. What are my thoughts, my feelings, my experiences that I can grasp and put out there and give them meaning without being trite in any way?
That's gorgeous. Last question. What inspires you?
My authors. My authors, my love of reading. I've been reading since before I have memory, and I have probably about 12,000 books in my home, literally. And there is nothing that gives me greater pleasure than reading. And so being able to learn from that and turn it and twist it and figure out, can I get 1/1,000th of that ability or beauty in a phrase? So I have a lot of curiosity. And so I read a lot. I research a lot. I would like to write more. And when I get more time, I shall.
Excellent. Well, I'd love to hear some of your work.
Okay. The fruits of summer. The onion. An allium of alliteration begging to peel back the layers. The first, always the most protective. The illusion of safety, yet a mere peel away to exposing all. Seemingly no way in, therefore no tears or burning of desire, all wrapped up tightly. The cut across the non-root end, as far away from the life source as one can get, exposing tissue-thin glossamer edges peeking out. The brittle, paper-like husk that denies the strong, assertive presence below, almost camouflaging the dense, rich, and juicy center. Is it worth the journey to slice, dice, mince, and weep? You betcha. The tomato. The epitome of hope springs eternal. Oh, for the squishy white bread and soft, luxurious mayo to cushion the thick, red, dripping slices. Will it be sweetness incarnated or a dusty, pale taste left lingering on the tongue? The corn. Do you eat it like a typewriter going across the rows or around and around, up and down, twirling the ends deftly between your fingers? Do you butter and salt or barely boil? Do the random kernels get stuck up and between your teeth to suck out later with a deep sigh of sweet satisfaction? How many ears can you eat, and who listens while you bite crisply into the heat and heart of summer? Wading through quicksand. My mother can no longer make coffee. She lives for her coffee in the morning and can hardly talk before her first few sips. The aides and I now make it and bring it to her in the soft, large recliner chair where she sits all day, every day. One morning, she spits it out and says it's horrible. A few months later, she forgets to drink it. Then she forgets to ask for it. My father has been totally deaf for 40 plus years. If his cochlear implants aren't in his ears, he is deaf to the world. I have a giant whiteboard and markers that I grab whenever I go into his bedroom, knowing his ears aren't in. "Put in your hearing aids," I simultaneously shout and scribble on the board. He generally ignores me and the board. I have to stand over him, gesturing and mouthing the words in the hopes he will read my lips. I'm loud, but it makes no difference. It's quiet in his head, like the snow drifting down, peaceful. I think he loves it. When he's ready, he puts them in. Until he does, we get nowhere. I'm waiting, but can offer no help or instructions until he decides. This is him having agency. His skin balloons around his ankles as they swell more every day. I insist that the hospice nurse look at his feet. They are huge some days, purple others, ugly and misshapen. He's embarrassed by his feet, but they are his feet. I love them, and I urge him often and loudly to put his recliner chair back and elevate them. They pain him. They cause him to shuffle. He trips over them. His giant white sneakers no longer fit, so he only wears socks. He cuts down the sides of all his white athletic socks so they do not indent painfully into his engorged ankles. I order him special socks that are no slip in the futile hope of avoiding falls. I even cut the sides before I give them to him, but he refuses to wear anything but his white athletic socks. I finally remove them all from his drawer and hide them, leaving him only the non-slip ones as options, leaving him little agency. He soon bullies me into returning his very slippery favorite socks. Mom and I are out shopping one day when it starts to rain. I tell her to hold the empty grocery bag she is carrying over her head to protect herself. She puts it over her face and head. We both laugh hysterically and move out of the rain. When she offers to help unload the dishwasher, she takes all the clean silverware out of the drawer and puts it into the dishwasher. She then looks confused and simply shrugs as I gently move her to her chair and sort out the silverware. My mother forgets to wash her hair and scratches at her scalp. I replace her shampoo with something better, stronger, more appropriate, but she forgets to use it or doesn't see it. We now must prompt her, "It's shower day. Let's get you all nice and clean and you'll feel better," I say 3 times a week. Her clothes hurt her skin. We move to oversized, loose-fitting shirts, which my sister sends, along with mail-order sweatpants. She happily dons her non-slip socks. She gave up her bra a year ago. I know she can't remember how to put it on or fasten it. She was an icon of fashion, of being well-dressed, clean, neat, well-coiffed, always. Despite our best efforts and daily care, there are days she looks close to slovenly. Eventually, she tries to stay in her pajamas all day. I find my dad lifting hand weights as he sits in his recliner, still trying for some strength somewhere in his body. His hands work, his legs not so much. Within a few months, he can barely walk from the car to the Olive Bar at the Big Y, which he calls Publix. He does 2 loops, finally filling a small plastic container with his favorite olives, all the time hanging on tightly to the metal edge of the condiment table. Then he staggers off to the front of the store, leaning, grabbing, holding on to shelves as he barely makes it to the bench next to the store exit. He sits facing the checkout aisles so he'll see me when I'm done shopping. He wakes at 1:21 a.m. screaming from the roar of the train in his head. He is quiet again finally, an hour later. I give him a lorazepam to calm the body and the brain. That was my first experience of calling hospice in the middle of the night. It was August 27th, and I remember my enormous relief that he didn't die on my birthday. He tells me the next day that he now knows what his first responder looks like, me. We repeat the scenario often over the next 2 years. Eventually, I share the role with the local fire department's lift assist guys who I need to pick him up off the bathroom or living room floor. That same night, my mom remembers back 10 years to his massive stroke, which felled him in the parking lot of a motel somewhere in South Carolina on their way to Florida for the winter. She thinks he's having another one. I give her an antacid, a gummy, and hope that a few hours of sleep will bring her back to calm. I tuck everyone in and go to sleep on their couch for the rest of the short night, with both ears tuned towards their bedroom. My mom is increasingly restless and gets up from her chair every 2 minutes to wander. "Where are you going?" I ask. "She's going to the bathroom," she replies. "But you just went to the bathroom," I explain. "I have to go again," she insists. This goes on endlessly, all day, every day. At first gently, and then with increasing frustration and lack of patience, I try to reason with her. I forget she cannot reason. Someone has to go with her every time she walks anywhere in the apartment. She is falling a lot. We always keep a hand on her arm or elbow. Sometimes she leans into the support, and sometimes she snaps, "Leave me alone." I do not. Eventually, we hire a live-in aide, and this becomes her job. I cannot yet comprehend the unrelenting restlessness combating my mother's body. I try for more patience, more gentle understanding. Some days are better for me than others. My dad often refers to me as Nurse Ratchet when he doesn't like what I have to say, which is quite often. A 2 or 3 year old says, "Why?" repeatedly. My 90-year-old dad says, "Leave me alone." Sometimes I retreat until his mood and needs shift. Sometimes I can't. Too much is at stake. I lose my patience a lot. Sometimes we can talk it through, and I have hope we will not be at odds that day around his safety or physical needs. But he rarely remembers our agreement to listen and try to understand the why of my requests. "I am just doing it to keep you safe," I repeat over and over and over again. And to me, in my brain, this means he will be alive longer. We are an army of aides, hospice workers, doctors and nurses, PT and OT, pharmacists and medical supply houses. When an OT comes in to evaluate how Dad can move more easily without exhausting himself, he tells her, "Leave me alone." I am the general running the army. I come by it naturally. I do a very good job and annoy everyone at some point, but I keep him safe. I keep my mother safe too until I can't any longer. I held both their hands when they died. I told them I love them. I did. I do. Four courses not eaten, aka salivating for extra credit. The amuse-bouche waits tiny in the center of the plate. I gently turn the dish left, then right. No clue. It's round, of course, that single bite. A soft, creamy something peeking through a panko-like coating. Not a crumb out of place or lingering anywhere, but within the main attraction. 3 inches above, a finger's worth of grape raspberry swipe garnishes the edge of the plate. No scent to speak of or tease me with as I bend forward from the waist, inching my nose close, then closer to this taste. There's nothing to do but take the plunge. A green second course, of course. Arugula, crisp and bitter, leaves laying softly with curling edges, overlapping like a giant bunch of tangled rope. The leafy bed embraces a host of dependents, desperate to make their mark, their taste soothing the bite of the lettuce. tiny crumbles of blue cheese, or perhaps goat if preferred. Slivered nuts whose identity doesn't matter in the least. Sweet, dried cranberries for the counter effect of bitter and sweet. It works. A light mustard vinaigrette lassos it all to the bowl. Enter the entree. It's the decision of this centerpiece that leaves one puzzled and pondering. Is the draw the protein choice, the go-whiz, the raw desire for a taste of animal, or the bitterness of mineral and plant? Do I want to wallow in a warm, fragrant immersion of pasta and cheese, licking the rich coating off my lips after each heavenly slurp? Or am I feeling strong enough to saw through a classic rubber chicken while dashing my dreams of crisp skin atop moist meat beneath? A roast by any other name would be meat, but perhaps I should consider ruby red beets, succulent squashes, tiny new potatoes, and quartered red onions, all drizzled with very good green and grassy olive oil. This is more to my taste tonight. This would fill me up with the wonder of the season and the richness of summer dirt. A roast by any other name is simply boiled. I choose the vegetables with some coarse sea salt and hand-ground pepper atop a drizzle of EVVO, roasted at 400 degrees for 20 minutes. The devil is in the details, or dessert as it may be. I always choose cheese over sweets. Chocolate be damned, or at least save for another meal, another time. I have never met a cheese cart I didn't love and salivate over. I cannot choose but three. I pay the surcharge always for an extra wedge, or perhaps two. I throw down the gauntlet and run the course. Satiation, satisfaction, sans check. Obit considered. Lisa Cohen Eckes, sometimes still Eckes Saffer on some legal paperwork, decided she'd had enough. She died in the midst of living her best life. She loved life, challenging as it was at times, many times. But she had no regrets, corny and trite but true. Maybe a mid-sized desire to be kinder, more patient, not interrupt so much, to be able to do more for others. She was generous, but wished always to be more so. She was fortunate to not have to pay the New York Times an excessively insane bounty to publish her obituary. So here we go. Family, they were always her number one priority, and will continue to be, since she believed in many lives, reincarnation, and time travel. Her love for her family, parents, sisters, children, and grandchild made her heart swell beyond the known universe. She'd go to the mat for them. She'd embrace and protect them as only a mother bear can. She'd lay down her life and offered several times to do so in a bargain with God. Fortunately, God never made her follow through. One of her greatest loves was books. Words, authors, learning, writing, editing, commentary, and of course, reading. There were never fewer than 80 to 100 books piled around her bedroom, many dust-covered from their long wait. Her bedside tables, stacked bookcases, the floor and shelf cubbies in her closet all staggered under her must-read authors. They waited patiently, old, new, have-to-read ASAP ones. She moved them around a lot, depending on her mood, the time of year, what she felt like reading next. Her goal was to read them all before she reached her inevitable expiration date. She knew that was impossible, so kept jockeying the must-read-before-I-die ones to the top of the piles. She read voraciously and wished always for a better memory of titles and themes. She loved very gently bending down the smallest corner of the bottom of a page to mark a special phrase or use of a word that struck or motivated her to read more of this author. She loved finding old friends in used bookstores. She always wished she had started recording the books she read from the time she was 4 or 5, before memory set in. She spent her whole life searching for the title of a children's book about a train that stops suddenly, and when it starts up again, everything is upside down and backwards. She loved Harriet the Spy and A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Let's not forget Amelia Bedelia, All in the Family, and Harry the Dirty Dog. The list was endless, and those revered children's books filled the bedroom closet to overflowing. Clothes and extra luggage be damned. Her favorite room was the 38 by 18 two-story all cherry wood library she designed and built, mostly to house her award-winning culinary library, reflecting her professional life. But there were also hundreds of novels, nonfiction, poetry, plays, and other tomes on topics she loved that snuck their way in. Many first editions signed and inscribed. They were all very happily shelved and always in alphabetical order by author and/or category. Okay, maybe there was one regret. She lamented she would never have time to reread the classics. She always wanted to, but with so much new good fiction and writer rabbit holes to go down, it just wasn't meant to be. Oh yes, if you want the list of where she was schooled, which nonprofits she supported, and what board she served on, go to the bio on her webpage. It's the stuff of rote reportage of a life by the book, so to speak. Meaningful, but not what defined Lisa. It was in the doing and the being of her many friends that gave her joy and purpose. Her happiest time was being with her family and many close women friends, loudly voicing an opinion or asking, "What? What did you say?" Not wanting to miss a word of any of the conversations. And oh, how she could talk. She loved to talk. She was a famously known interrupter, not ever meaning to be rude, but rather being breathless to get out a thought and afraid the time wouldn't allow it. She worked hard on listening more until the very end. She also loved her 250-year-old farmhouse, which she lived in for more than half a century, lovingly and expensively renovating it. Anyone who entered her home immediately felt embraced by joy. Her parties and gatherings were legendary, and the joke in the community was that Lisa always cooked for the whole kibbutz. It was easier for her to cook for 50 than for 6. Lisa had a love of ceramics, art, and myriad old things she uprooted and unearthed from antique stores and local auctions. Not bad addictions, she'd say, buying books and old wonderful artifacts to integrate into her collections. Stylish clutter pretty much described her home. And her kitchen, ah, her kitchen. So many dishes cooked from the 3 refrigerators stocked to the gills. She was always ready to pour a glass of wine and offer up snacks or dinner to friends who dropped by to visit. Lisa once labeled herself a connector, and that was what she loved most, to connect people. Friends, colleagues, often strangers with like-minded lives and interests that she thought should meet each other. Rare was a week that she didn't host or entertain, right up until the end. The end, yet to be written, but oh, what a journey. L'chaim.
Thank you so much, Lisa. You can find more information about Lisa on her publishing company's website, Ekus Group, EKUSGroup.com.
Come visit us online, and if you can, share a little abundance, because we are a nonprofit and exist through this community. We would love to see you at a reading or hear about a book you're enjoying right now. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon with another local author. Until then.